Good afternoon, and welcome to the Friedrichs versus CTA briefing conference call. At this time, all lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will now turn the call over to your host, Ms. Caroline Friedrichsen.
Hello, everybody, and thank you, Tammy, for opening up the call. I'm Caroline Friedrichsen. I'm the president of the American Constitution Society. I'm very glad to have you all with us today to talk about one of the very most important cases in front of the court this term. It has significant possible impacts, and we have a couple of wonderful, wonderful people here to talk with us about the case. Before I introduce them, I'm going to just give a little background on the case for those of you who have not delved into the actual legal questions involved. But in this case, it's Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association. The petitioners in this case, the Friedrichs petitioners, are looking to overturn a 1977 Supreme Court ruling in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education that has allowed unions to collect what are known as fair share fees from their non-union employees to cover the costs of the benefits they receive through the collective bargaining process in contract administration and the administration of the grievance process. Now, Abood is a longstanding precedent, and since it was issued, has been upheld by the court until Justice Alito has recently invited a challenge to the Abood case in his opinion in Harris versus Quinn last term. So Friedrichs is a very interesting case because it comes to the court in a very strange procedural posture, which I'm sure our speakers will get into. But there's no factual record in this case. The petitioners filed this case in a California federal district court less than 2 years before the Supreme Court accepted it on certiorari. At the district court and circuit court levels, the petitioners moved for judgment on the pleadings against themselves. And I'll say that again, against themselves. They were saying they should lose in order to speed this case to the Supreme Court. They want to directly challenge the precedent, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. The case in this particular area, like so many anti-worker, anti-union initiatives, is being funded by the Center for Individual Rights, which is a far-right, very anti-union organization. So the fair share issue that is at issue in this case, basically the way it plays out is this, that if teachers in the California system are object to being a part of the union, they can opt out of paying full union dues by simply checking a box on a form they receive once a year and sending it back to the union. And in California, the public sector unions must represent everyone, whether they've opted out of their full union dues or not. And as a result, in order to cover the costs of the basic administration of the collective bargaining agreement and grievance administration and so forth, these employees have to support the costs only of those efforts in order to avoid them simply being free riders off the union, getting all the benefits of higher wages, as well as a grievance process, but not actually helping to support the organization that provides that to them. So the petitioners in this case are now challenging that fair share, longstanding fair share arrangement on two fronts under the First Amendment. The first is that they claim that fair share fees are coerced speech because any fees paid to the union may go to activities they disagree with, including collective bargaining, but not, I will say, political speech, which is not part of any fair share agreement. Simply, they're saying they have a free speech right to object to collective bargaining and thereby to have lower wages. This would be a direct attack on Abood. The second claim they raise is that the opt-out provision, and this may sound familiar to those of you who are following the reproductive rights cases, they say that checking a box not to pay full union dues is a burden on their First Amendment rights. They instead say that there should be an opt-in provision that requires employees who want to be union members to affirmatively state that that they will pay the full union dues on an annual basis, regardless of whether or not they are already union members. These issues were adjudicated nearly 40 years ago in Abood, but the right has an interest in overturning longstanding precedent and the relationships in employment that have served teachers, public employees, and governments that employ them extremely well. So to talk to us and get into some of the arguments in the case, two people who were involved with some splendid briefs are Sam Bagenstos and Emily Martin. And I'll start with Sam, who is the Frank G. Millard Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School. And before going to Michigan, he served as the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the Department of Justice. He has been deeply involved in workers' rights cases before the Supreme Court. And in fact, in the last term, he argued for the petitioner in Young versus UPS. In this case, the Friedrichs case, he has authored the amicus brief on behalf of municipalities in support of the California Teachers Association. Emily Martin is the Vice President and General Counsel for the National Women's Law Center. Prior to joining the National Women's Law Center, Emily served as the Deputy Director of Women's Rights at the American Civil Liberties Union, where her work focused on the needs of low-income women and women of color. The National Women's Law Center has also filed an amicus brief in this case, focusing on the benefits that public sector unions have provided to women and communities of color. And I do want to say one thing before I turn this over to Sam to start our conversation, which is that many of you may be interested in having CLE credits for this call, and I would direct you to contact Matt Scoble at ACS, and we can follow up with his email later on in the call for those of you who want to make sure you get credit. So with that, Sam, I hope you will start the conversation by framing the case a little more and talking about your brief in particular.
Sure. So I appreciate everybody here to listen to this. This is a very important case. It's going to be a very important case for workers' rights. But one of the points that we're trying to make in the amicus brief that we filed was that this is also going to be a very important case for municipal employers and the efficiency of government services. So I filed an amicus brief on behalf of a little more than two dozen municipalities from across the country and about the same number of municipal officials from other jurisdictions. And my clients, you know, include a lot of places that you might not expect to sign on to a brief in a case like this. Fairbanks, Alaska, Louisville, Kentucky, the mayor of Huntington, West Virginia, Toledo, Ohio, lots and lots of folks. Of course, also the very big cities around the country, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, Boston. And they wanted the court to hear that as it sort of is engaged in what seems like potentially a headlong rush to overturn this longstanding Abood precedent, that actually the consequences for municipalities, for government agencies, and as employers, and for the efficient delivery of public services, might be very significant. And so the court really ought not to overrule Abood. And we make basically three arguments. The first argument is sort of organized around one of the fundamental principles of stare decisis, the idea that the court shouldn't overrule its precedents without a special justification, and that's that in areas where a court's precedents have established, have engendered a degree of reliance that's reflected in contracts, that is an area where the court should be especially wary of changing course because people arrange their affairs around the court's decisions. And as we show, my clients, as well as hundreds if not thousands of municipalities around the country have entered into collective bargaining agreements with unions that represent their workers that include these kinds of fair share fees. If the court were to declare fair share fees unconstitutional, by which it would do by overruling Abood, that would instantly throw labor relations in all of these hundreds if not thousands of municipalities into chaos. All these collective bargaining agreements would have to be renegotiated. They'd have to be renegotiated in circumstances in which the unions would be likely to be more militant. There would be more labor strife. Things would be very difficult. So just on kind of standard stare decisis grounds, our first point was overruling Abood would cause very significant disruptions. But there is a second point, and the second point we made is that overruling Abood would also destabilize the law and the legal precedents that my clients as municipal employers rely on to run their operations efficiently outside of the union context. So the Supreme Court in a series of cases dating back to the 1960s, but including some very recent cases decided by the conservative majority of the Supreme Court, has given public employers broad latitude to discipline their employees for engaging in speech that is not speech as a citizen on matters of public concern, or that speech that undermines the efficient delivery of public services. And one of the things that opinions by both Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia emphasize in recent years is that, of course, everybody has First Amendment rights, but when you're a public employee, when you're a public employee and you're not speaking in your capacity as a citizen, but instead you're engaging in speech that relates directly to your workplace, arises entirely out of your workplace, and just has to do with the ordinary terms and conditions of work, and your employer has the same right as any other employer to discipline you for violating rules of the workplace in the context of that speech. And if the court were to say that collecting an agency fee, which, as Caroline said, can only be used to finance collective bargaining over terms and conditions of employment and grievance administration and related things, if the court were to say that collecting that agency fee violated the First Amendment, they would have to conclude that the agency fee and the speech that it promotes is speech that gets First Amendment protection, which would completely undermine the distinction between speech as a citizen and speech as an employee that my clients as public employers really rely on so that they can run their enterprises. And, you know, it's not just me who says that that's an important distinction. It's also Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy in opinions of the Supreme Court over the last several years who have made clear that in order to run municipal enterprises, in order to make sure that they're doing the work of the people, municipal governments have to have broad authority to impose discipline on their workers, just like any other employer. And a ruling for the challengers here to overrule Abood would really throw that whole area of law into chaos and lead to great uncertainty for my clients. And it's precisely that uncertainty that the court, in opinions by Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy, has emphasized over and over. That impedes the efficient delivery of services. And the final point that we make from the perspective of municipal employers, which is also very important, is that the fair share fee arrangement, which is necessary to unions to enable them to overcome this free rider problem, has led, at least in the municipalities I'm representing and in many others, to strong and stable unions that have been effective partners with the municipal governments in finding efficiencies that otherwise wouldn't be found in delivering municipal services. And they've actually saved a lot of money, like millions of dollars worth of money in various municipalities through the years. And the insight here is pretty straightforward, which is that, you know, the workers who are doing the work often can see what their bosses can't about how inefficient various practices at the workplace are. But they don't have any individual incentive to bring those inefficiencies to the attention of their bosses unless they can feel like they're going to get to share in some of the benefits of the efficiencies they receive. And a strong and stable union of the sort that's financed by a fair share fee can do that. And so we provide examples from many of my own clients as well as many other cities of, for example, King County, Washington, which is one of my clients, engaged in a productivity initiative with the union that represents its employees, which over the course of a number of years found over $70 million in savings, which was able to be shared between the workers and the taxpayers. In Chicago, another of my clients, the employees who run garbage trucks said, you know, the routes that we're using for garbage trucks actually are very inefficient, and we could cut out a lot of overtime if you just changed the way that you routed the garbage trucks through the city. And in fact, went to the union that represented those employees went to the city and said, you know, you could save a lot of money, and they're ending up saving $7 million as a result of that change. In Toledo, Ohio, another client I represent, the workers came to the city government and said, you know, we're having a lot of safety problems, and we think we could have a peer safety training where employees are responsible for training other employees in safe work practices. And if we implement this, because we understand how this works, this can solve a lot of injury problems, and the city has saved money in absenteeism and in workers' compensation costs. And as we showed, I mean, these are a few examples, but there are dozens of examples from around the country of employers, municipal employers, working with their unions to save money and provide services more efficiently at greater value for the taxpayers, all of which could be undone if the court were to say that the fair share fee regime were unconstitutional. And so our basic point is, if you're thinking about this simply from the perspective of union versus other employees, you're thinking about it wrong, that actually municipal employers and the taxpayers who finance their activities and should be getting their services have a very significant interest in not overruling a boot.
Yeah,
so that's what
you.
I have to say.
That was an excellent exposition, and I think lays out very nicely what how the interests of the governments come into this. And there are a very large array of wonderful briefs that have been filed. Emily's brief with the National Women's Law Center and other civil rights organizations lays out the interests of the workers, in particularly women and people of color, and the role that the public sector unions have played in significantly narrowing the wage gap, in advancing those workers' rights particularly. And so with that, I'll open it up to you, Emily, to talk a little bit about your brief and the arguments that you and the other organizations make.
Thanks so much, Caroline. So as Caroline says, the National Women's Law Center worked with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, as well as Gender and Block, to write this brief on behalf of about 70 civil rights and progressive economic organizations to really talk about why this case about public sector unions is also a case about equality. So women make up the majority of public sector union members, and the majority of women in unions are in public sector unions. And in addition, more than 30% of public sector union members are racial and ethnic minorities, which in part reflects the historical importance of government employment as a pathway to the middle class for African Americans in particular. And women of color in particular have historically had high unionization rates compared to other demographic groups. So why does this matter? Our brief was set out to do is to make the case that because this case will determine the health and viability of public sector unions, as a result, it will have an outsized impact on the economic fortunes of women and people of color, and also for LGBT workers who depend upon the protections and union contracts in the absence of explicit legal protections against discrimination in many states. So unions in general, and public sector unions in particular, are one of the most successful vehicles for providing economic and professional opportunities for American workers. They are a path to the middle class, they raise wages, and they reduce inequality both within the broader economy and within the workforce. And that specifically includes reducing gender inequality, reducing racial inequality, and reducing inequality based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And when workers come together to collectively bargain and enforce the terms of that bargain through grievance procedures, All the workers represented by the union, union members and non-members alike, benefit, and the data shows they significantly benefit. And again, those benefits are particularly important to those who are otherwise most vulnerable to discrimination in the workforce, so those who otherwise have the least bargaining power. So that includes women, that includes people of color, and that includes LGBT individuals. And these protections are important because we there still are a lot of deep inequalities in the workplace. So just to point to the wage gap as an indicator that that indicates a lot, since there are a lot of different sorts of obstacles and inequalities that go to the wage gap. Women are paid 79 cents for every dollar paid to their male counterparts. African-American and Hispanic women are paid 60 cents and 55 cents, respectively, for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men. And although women are slightly less than half of the overall workforce, they're about two-thirds of the low-wage workforce, and nearly half of those women in the low-wage workforce are women of color. Men of color also experience a wage gap. African-American men typically earn 73% of what white non-Hispanic men earned in 2014. For Hispanic men, it was 62%. And the best data we have shows that gay and bisexual men also earn less than similarly qualified heterosexual men, 10 to 32 cents less on the dollar, and lesbian women earn less still. Now, again, that's just one sort of quick set of indicators of inequality, but the economy still is stacked against women and people of color and LGBT individuals in significant ways. So unions lift the wages of workers overall, but what's true for workers overall is, for instance, even more true for women. So the union wage benefit is greater both in percentage terms and in absolute terms for women than for men. For example, looking specifically at public sector workers, women public sector workers represented by unions earn on average $192 more a week than women public sector workers not represented by unions. For men, it's $108 more per week. So it's bigger in absolute terms as well as by percentage. Similarly, if you look at other demographic breakdowns, African-American women union members make about 34% more than African-American women who aren't represented by unions. For Latina union members, it's a whole 46% more than Latina non-union members. And wages are not only higher for women in unions, they're also more equal. So unions are associated with smaller wage gaps related to both gender and race, in part because they promote transparency in criteria that that wages will be based on. They promote transparency in decisions about compensation and recruitment and promotions. So while the gender wage gap for non-union workers is about 18 cents for full-time workers, for union members, it's about 11 cents. And for public sector workers, that's even more true. For non-unionized public sector workers, there's about a 20-cent wage gap. For unionized public sector workers, there's about a 10-cent wage gap. And again, when you break down the demographics by race and look at African-American women and you look at Latina women, the wage gap also shrinks in really significant ways. And it's not just wages, it's also benefits that provide stability and security to workers and their families. So workers represented by unions have far greater access to pensions, to paid sick days, to employer-provided health insurance, to paid parental leave. So again, just to take one example, women overall in the economy are less likely than men to have employer-provided health insurance. But when we look at individuals represented by unions, the percentage of women and men with employer-provided health insurance is greater, and the gender gap is lower. So being represented by a union means both greater access to benefits and more equitable access to benefits. And unions also provide important protections against discriminations, and that's important for all workers, but it's particularly important for LGBT workers, because only 19 states and the District of Columbia explicitly prohibit employment discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Federal law does not explicitly have that prohibition. But unions, including public sector unions, frequently bargain specifically to protect LGBT workers. So, for example, AFSCME has negotiated over 1,000 union contracts that prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, and many of these reach gender identity discrimination as well. So as a result, the grievance procedures established through unions frequently provide the primary or sometimes even the sole recourse for workers who face discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. And they also provide critical protections for workers who face race discrimination or sex discrimination to obtain more immediate recourse than will often be available if you're going through the course. Now, critically, these benefits flow not only to union members, but to the non-members represented by unions. So that is individuals who, like the Challengers and Friedrichs, argue they shouldn't be required to pay public sector union dues despite unions' obligations to represent their interests. One other point that our brief makes that I want to mention is that we can see a little bit what the impact would be of overruling Abood and letting individuals represented by unions opt out of paying for the benefits that unions provide by looking at right-to-work states where legislation entitles workers who are non-union members to union contract benefits without paying fair share fees. And in those states, studies that attempt to correct for differences in the economy find that wages are on average 3.2% lower for everyone, not just for unionized workers, than wages in non-right-to-work states. And again, that's even when controlling for worker characteristics and state labor market conditions. And when you look at these studies, women are harmed more than men by the wage conditions in right-to-work states. So wages in right-to-work states were 4.4% lower for women who work full-time and year-round than non-right-to-work states, while for men the difference was 1.7%. So again, unions in general and public sector unions in particular are real engines of opportunity for workers who are otherwise the most vulnerable in our economy. And we argued to the court in our brief that this goes to the reliance interests on Abood, the sets of decisions that people have made for almost 40 years based on particular expectations about the economy, which flow from the legal structure set out in Abood. So public sector workers often choose their careers and commit to public service in part because of the benefits and opportunities that union-negotiated contracts offer. And millions of workers have chosen to serve their communities as teachers, as nurses, as firefighters, as other public servants, despite an overall wage penalty for choosing public sector work, with the reasonable expectation they could continue to obtain the basic economic opportunities provided by union representation, equal opportunity, fair wages, health insurance, and other benefits. And if the court overturns Abood and weakens the ability of public sector unions to achieve those benefits, those losses will be felt most strongly by the women, the people of color, the LGBT individuals who relied upon unions to provide real pathways to opportunity, pathways to the middle class. So we hope that that is persuasive to at least some folks on the court, and that was our argument.
Emily, thank you so much. I think that really summarizes some of the extraordinary contributions that the public sector unions have made, particularly for women and people of color in the workforce. I know we have quite a large number of people on the call, and I want to open it up right away because I want to get as many questions on the table as we can. So, Tammy, can you explain to people how to ask questions?
The lines are now open for questions. If you would like to ask a question, you can do so by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We do have a question. Our first question comes from Brian Weeks with the Minnesota Judiciary. Your line is live.
Hi, I guess I misunderstood the instructions early on, and I just wanted to reserve my right to ask a question, but I don't necessarily have one at the moment.
All right, are there other questions on the line?
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Well, I'll jump in the interim as we're waiting for the questions to queue up. And this is really for both of you. Can you talk a little bit more about the reliance interests, both from employer government side and from the employee side, and how that factors into the legal arguments in the case?
Sam, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so I think the reliance interests are very important. Certainly from the employer side, the reliance interests are important because whenever the Supreme Court considers whether it's going to overrule precedent, the most significant factor they consider, and they've said this over and over, is whether their prior decision had engendered significant reliance. In the case of Abood, I mean, we really have a decision that has structured labor relations in states all across the country and cities all across the country for nearly 40 years. It's something that's very well entrenched. It's something that every time a collective bargaining agreement is negotiated in the public sector, it's one of the background principles. And so, as we said, there are probably thousands, if not more, of collective bargaining agreements right now that include these fees. And that's particularly important, too, because the kind of reliance that the court has said often is the most important kind of reliance is reliance that's reflected in contracts. That what we really want to make sure is that the court's not pulling the rug out from under folks who have entered into contractual arrangements based on their understanding that the law is going to stay the way it is. So I think that's exceptionally important just as a reliance interest. I think it's also important that all of the kinds of very efficient and helpful relationships and helpful arrangements that municipalities have entered into with their unions wouldn't have happened if there wasn't a union there that understood it could plan for the long term, that it would have the resources so long as it retained the support of its workers. It would have the resources to really be representing the workers in that workplace for a long period of time. It's the long-term vision that having stable unions allows that enabled the union in King County, Washington, to work with the county to say, well, over 10 years, we're going to save tens of millions of dollars. If they have to worry about the next day and the next week and the next month because they don't have stable financing to do the representation that it's their job to do, then they're not going to be able to engage in these kinds of very efficient and helpful activities.
Thank you, Emily.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that, but I would just, I guess, reemphasize something that Sam said, which is one reason why reliance is so critical here is because this is a direct frontal result of a frontal assault on a previous Supreme Court decision. The challengers here aren't asking the Supreme Court to tinker with Abood, to read it narrowly. They're asking for a decision that stood for over 40 years and that has been really critical to structuring these relationships to be overturned. And so that is when reliance interests are really quite relevant. And again, the story that we tried to tell in our brief to add to the picture that Sam paints is that people really choose careers and lives based on expectations about the qualities of public sector jobs. And those qualities are often associated with having strong union representation in the public sector, which is made possible by allowing unions to be able to financially afford to provide the benefits that they provide to workers. And so we hope that by setting out a little bit of that story of why it is that people make the choices they make about the work they do, that it will urge the court to really consider carefully before upending this decades of expectations that have been built up in the economy around the legal structure the court previously created.
Thank you. Tammy, do we have questions in the queue?
I have no questions in queue at this time.
All right. Well, if anybody has questions out there, please queue up. But in the interim, I would just ask another question, which I think is very interesting about this case. I mentioned briefly the very strange procedural posture, the fact that the parties who were bringing the case basically tried to get it to the Supreme Court as fast as possible by arguing against their own position. So essentially moving it at an expedited rate without any factual record below. So do you think, either of you, that there's a chance the court might change its mind in hearing this case? There's no oral argument scheduled yet. It seems kind of bizarre. Are there other cases that have come up in this particular way?
Well, it does seem bizarre. I think that that the Center for Individual Rights was responding to some clear invitations extended by Justice Alito in particular to bring this question up to the court. So unfortunately, it got here because at least some members of the court asked for it to come here in this way and this quickly. But maybe Sam is more optimistic about the court deciding not to decide this case after all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. They pretty rarely decide not to decide a case once they've granted it. Although it does, you know, happen once or twice a year. I do think though that there's a real possibility that the Center for Individual Rights and the plaintiffs here have overread the possibility that they're going to win this case. I mean, obviously they rushed to the court in part because they wanted to be the ones to get the decision that interred Abood once and for all. But, you know, the Supreme Court signaled before in the Knox case a few years back, also a 5-4 opinion written by Justice Alito, that they might be open to overruling Abood. And when they granted cert in the Harris case 2 terms ago, the argument made by the challengers to the fee in Harris was specifically that Abood should be overruled, and the court did not go there, although once again said negative things about Abood, but did not say they were overruling Abood. So, you know, they have already kind of gotten to the brink and shied away. It's entirely possible they'll do that again, and it's really hard to know what the court's going to do. It's a very, very strange posture. It's a very strange posture of the case. And it's a little bit, I would say, unseemly, right? That this is not a case that proceeds through kind of ordinary adjudication. This is a case that's obviously, everyone knows, it's just a vehicle to get in front of the Supreme Court before anyone else. And you know, moving for judgment on the pleadings against yourself in the lower courts to speed that along is an indication of that. I do think the lack of a factual record in the case is one of the reasons why it's so important that there was such robust amicus briefing in this case, because I think the challengers to Abood are really trying to tell a story about what that decision is and means and has resulted in that's inconsistent with the way it's worked in the world. And I think the amicus briefs on the side of the defendants and on the side of Abood here really helped to flesh out that story.
Right. Well, thank you. That was very helpful. And I would ask Tammy one more time, if there are any questions in the queue?
Yes, we do have a question. We have a question from David Florin. Your line is live. Hello?
Hi, my mute button was off. Hello, my mute button was off there for a second. This is more of a question for Sam. I'd read a piece by an SEIU local counsel talking about how there may be unintended consequences of an overruling of Abood. And he said that so far those who have advocated for overturning Abood haven't spent much time addressing whether employment should be treated differently from other benefits or opportunities provided by the government. But if the court accepts the argument in Abood that basically the Perry versus Sinderman argument that the government may never condition the granting of a benefit on providing financial support to an entity that engages in expressive activity that an individual finds objectionable, then a decision in overturning Abood could have unexpected and wide-ranging implications. For instance, if you consider Alcatraz Island, where Alcatraz Cruises has a monopoly over how to get to the island. You have to pay $30 to get there. If it turns out that Alcatraz Cruises takes up positions that are objectionable to a visitor, a would-be visitor, they may have an argument that they shouldn't pay the fee at all. And I was wondering how, is that going too far with the exploration of unintended consequences?
Well, so I think the answer is it's really hard to know what the extent of consequences would be of overruling Ubud. You know, once you take the idea that being required to pay a fee for something that's not political speech, but that's just, you know, something even as mundane as the cost of administering a grievance arbitration system is a violation of the First Amendment, and the court would have to say that in order to overrule Ubud. Once you say that, I do think it raises a lot of questions about, well, what other fees that you're required to spend will be treated as violations of the First Amendment. And I saw that same article that you're talking about. I think it's a real question, and I think it could lead the court into a sort of morass where they have to find ways of distinguishing things. I mean, nobody's going to say that the Alcatraz case that you're talking about would be a violation of the First Amendment, but then they have to explain why in ways that may kind of layer on lots of unprincipled seeming distinction. But even before you get sort of to the outer edges like that, there's still much more directly the unraveling of public employee speech doctrine, which is a body of doctrine that really has been built by the conservatives on the Supreme Court, including, you know, the members of the people who I think the challengers to Ubud would like to think of as their majority. And so I do think that when really confronted with this question, the court's going to have to pause a little bit and say, do we really want to overrule this case that's existed for 40 years that has actually been doing just fine, people have been just fine with. There are people who don't like it now, just like any case. There are people who didn't like it at the time, but in fact, labor relations in the public sector have accommodated to it and thrived under it, and overruling it could cause lots of consequences that some we can predict that will be very difficult to unravel, and some that we can't predict, and why do we even want to go down that road? I think that there's a substantial chance and hope that the justices who may have felt on a headlong rush to overrule Ubud when actually confronted with that will say, why do we need to mess with something that seems to be working okay?
I would just pipe in to say I agree with Sam that one really helpful argument, which Sam's brief makes, is that that if any conversation basically about conditions in a public sector workplace is considered political speech, then that does really threaten to overturn rules that conservative justices have liked in the past, saying you can discipline a public employee for things that he or she says in the course of his or her work, about his or her work, that is not a First Amendment problem. That is not political speech per se. So I think one hopeful thing is that it is somewhat difficult to cabin a notion of political speech that wouldn't also empower public employees to say all sorts of things without discipline by their public employer in a way that I think would make some of the conservative justices uncomfortable.
This is Caroline. Just as a corollary, I wonder, would that make the Hatch Act unconstitutional? You don't have to go there. As a former federal employee, it's an interesting question. But Tammy, anyone else on the line?
I have no further questions in queue at this time.
All right. Well, anyone queue up if you have a question, but if not, I just want to repeat again that for those of you who want CLE credit on this call, you should contact Matt Scoble. His email is mscoble@acslaw.org. And I did want to mention two other things. One is for those of you who want to know who's actually doing some work on the outside of the courtroom around this, there's a group called America Works Together. You can find them online, and they have opportunities for people to plug in to write op-eds and letters and so forth. And so I just mention that in case you want to get further involved. At ACS, we've also recently published a wonderful issue brief by Professor Ann Hodges. That's available on the ACS website. And if you want to learn more about the case, that is a great place to go, as well as if you look at America Works Together, their website has all of the amicus briefs that have been filed, as well as action opportunities. So unless, Tammy, you have any other calls, I would like to thank our speakers, Sam and Emily. This has been a terrific conversation. We really appreciate everything that you're doing and for joining us for this call. And thank you, everybody on the line, for joining us. And if you do have any questions afterwards, please reach out to us. You have Matt's email now. I think most of you probably have my email. We look forward to hearing from you. And so thank you all again, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect your lines.